Sarah?
Yes.
Do you want to have?
Court or the district court in an expungement proceeding. And it was erroneous, first, because there was no sanctionable conduct. And second, the sanctions aren't authorized under any applicable rules. Mr. Nikitas represented his client for a long period of time in an expungement proceeding where he sought to and successfully got his arrest and charges expunged in a case that was dismissed. And in the expungement order, he added an additional provision that found that there was no probable cause for the arrest or the restraining order, which is something that's not specifically in the expungement statute, but it's not prohibited in the expungement statute either. Mr. Nikitas was never hit anything. He provided the proposed order in court when he appeared to represent Mr. Scheffler at the hearing, and specifically said in the hearing that he had added his own paragraph 5 and 6. Paragraph 6 was a paragraph that turned out to be controversial.
He said that he had done so or he would do so in the future?
He said, no, he came to the court with his own proposed order. Originally, the defendant had been appearing pro se and had used the form order.
Right.
And then Mr. Nikitas appeared at the hearing and brought his own proposed order, and he specifically said at the hearing, I believe on page 10, I believe, of that hearing transcript, that he had added page 5 and 6 to his proposed, he'd added paragraphs 5 and 6 to his proposed order.
Could I ask, I'm a little bit unclear about the facts and you're getting to it, but if I could ask it this way. So there were 3 proposed orders along the way. The third one was signed. The first one was done by the client pro se, the second one by Mr. Nikitas. And the second one's not in the record, right?
It is.
It is in the record.
Yeah, it's attached to his declaration. It's in the addendum.
Okay.
There's a proposed order he submitted in court, and then he followed up with another proposed order where he had forgotten to put an X on a particular box that he should have put an X on, and so he explains in the chain of emails.
Okay, I'm sorry. Could you? Well, I'll go ahead. I'll try to find it.
But apropos of the same topic. So you are saying that Mr. Nikitas brought, so there was an original order from the client pro se. And then there's a hearing on September 24th. And that you are saying that it's in the record that Mr. Nikitas brought his proposed order, including paragraphs 5 and 6, to that hearing. My concern is in the district court's findings on addendum 62, paragraph 11 in your addendum, the district court heard the testimony from the prosecutor that said that the language was not in the proposed order that he reviewed, the prosecutor reviewed at the hearing on September 24th, and the court found that testimony credible. So did the court not find, as a matter of factual matter, that the proposed order that was shared among counsel at that hearing did not include paragraphs 5 and 6?
You know, I think the court was inspecific about that. It said that he found the prosecutor's testimony to be credible, but you have to look at the actual record, which where Mr. Nikitas says at the hearing, it's in the transcript that he added paragraphs 5 and 6 to the proposed order. So he's saying that he added those paragraphs, and Mr. Scheffler, it's private. The defendant testified at that hearing that language was specifically discussed at the hearing, and the judge didn't make any particular findings on his testimony. I think he just ignored his testimony.
But it's very confusing, I think, let's put it this way. The first proposed order that's discussed on September 24th,
right.
Okay? Then later there's an emailed order that gets into the record, right?
Right?
And that's the one that's signed that contains it. But the question is, I think on September 24th, that proposed order, it's accurate to say, was never filed in court. By September 24th.
No, it was not put on file.
Okay.
Mr. Nikitas offered to get the order addressed right then and there, but the judge had requested that instead, that he emailed the order instead.
So the district court on September 24th did not see the order including a paragraph 5 or 6?
No.
Okay. And then the prosecutor, you're saying, did see it, but I have concerns about that, given the findings, factual finding of the court that the prosecutor did not see that on that date.
I mean, the reality is the prosecutor didn't notice it. I mean, because there's no dispute whatsoever that the email that the judge signed, the emailed order that the judge signed, was copied to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor is apologetic.
Absolutely, yes. And right, so paragraphs 5 and 6 end up in the order, and we have some confusion about what was happening on September 24th, I would say, within the parties who were there. Paragraphs 5 and 6 aren't described content-wise at that hearing. They're just referenced by number. And then in the later email by Mr. Nikitas to the prosecutor, and I think then submitting it to the court, it includes paragraphs 5 and 6. And states that the state stipulated to them. Okay, it says that the order was stipulated to at September 24th. To me, that seems like quite an overstatement of what happened at September 24th, given the vagaries about what the prosecutor even had at that time. And I don't actually see a stipulation in the record. Okay. I see the word yeah.
I think there's confusion, and you know, again, Mr. Nick, you know, this is confusion. The judge had asked a certain process to be filed, and so Mr. Nikitas, you see, is explicitly offering at the hearing and suggesting that they just work out the order right then and there, and it's the judge that tells him to email it.
Right.
So he chooses not to review the order at the time, so there's only a little bit of discussion about issues that the prosecutor noticed at the time. So the record is vague as to what happened at the hearing, but it's not the fault of Mr. Nikitas. So now he's effectively being punished for following the procedure.
Right, but Mr. Nikitas does describe that hearing as a stipulation, unless there's some other stipulation you can point to in the record.
I think there's, stipulation might be a little bit, that might not be the precise language, because yes, the judge did tell them to, I mean, the prosecutor did indicate that he was okay with the order except for a certain language. The judge had some issues. He wanted any legal authority for the prosecutor had a problem where he thought there was something in the order about giving legal advice, and the judge had questions about whether there's authority that the person shouldn't have to disclose their arrest without committing perjury, which actually is part of the statute, but the judge took it out. So they had focused on different aspects of the order. They didn't focus on the language that turned out to be controversial. So I think, you know, Mr. Nikitas has represented that he provided the same order by email that he provided in the courtroom. The defendant testified to that. But in any event, and, you know, there's certainly no certainty. There's no way that the judge could have found with certainty that the prosecutor didn't see it, because the prosecutor wasn't certain as to whether he saw it. He never noticed it when it was emailed either. And so,
well, the court found that the prosecutor credibly testified that the language was not in the proposed order at the hearing.
And frankly, I think when you look in the whole scheme of things, that was a convenient finding on the part of the judge.
Why is it clearly erroneous?
Because first of all, there isn't strong enough evidence to support. I think the judge could have decided that the prosecutor didn't see the language, but I don't think there's sufficient evidence for the judge to actually decide with certainty that the language wasn't in the order, because after all, the prosecutor didn't even notice it. There's no dispute whatsoever that the order was emailed to the prosecutor and he had a chance to look at it at the time, and he didn't see it. So if he didn't see it at the time, how can the judge conclude with any kind of certainty or even by the requisite preponderance of the evidence that the prosecutor, that it hadn't been there originally? So that's a problematic finding, and I think you have to look at it in the context of the larger case that the judge waited 2 years after the incident before he issued an order to show cause for sanctions. So he was obviously angry at Mr. Nikitas for contesting the proceeding so vigorously, and the case got remanded. After the judge amended the order, the case got remanded by this court for more findings, and then there was another hearing held, and then it was after that that the judge decided to issue an order to show cause for something that at that point had happened 2 years ago. It also, I think the court, and I was going to put it in a footnote in the brief. Unfortunately, I forgot that this particular district judge has been overruled on sanctions before in the case of Henry Cascarano, which is 871 Northwest 2nd, 34, in 2015. But you know, there is no dispute whatsoever that the prosecutor saw the order when it was emailed to
the
judge.
At least by the email.
Yes.
At least at that point. And the prosecutor admits, apparently, that he just didn't notice it.
Yes. So he's admitted that the language was there. He didn't notice it. He had a chance to see it. So there really was not damaging conduct. There was not any unethical conduct here on the part of Mr. Nikitas, because he had a chance to review the order ahead of time. This wasn't some kind of lengthy proposed findings of fact and conclusions where you had to go through dozens of pages. This is this order is two pages plus a signature. The city attorney presumably has looked at these before. He was in a position to take a look at the order and see if there's shouldn't have taken more than 5 minutes to look at that order and see if there was something in there he didn't think belonged. And the judge should have done it as well. And the judge says at the hearing, shame on me. So, you know, they're not on trial here. You know, whether they did right or wrong isn't the issue. The issue is whether Mr. Nikitas should have been sanctioned for their not reading the order carefully enough. And his responsibility.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with all of that. I think that the question comes down to is district court doesn't have a proposed order on September 24th. That's clear.
Yes.
There's dispute factually over whether the prosecutor did. There's no description of the contents of paragraph 5 and 6, although paragraphs 5 and 6 are referenced at September 24th, right? No discussion of context. And then all the focus is on paragraph 4. And then later it's like, okay, email the thing. It's like, here's the stipulated to agreement, and I included paragraph 4. To call the rest, now true, everyone should read carefully, but to actually receive from a colleague or from a lawyer representation that it's a stipulated to agreement, it's hard to see paragraphs 5 and 6 stipulated to. That's my concern.
Okay, well, the prosecutor would know what was stipulated to, and so he's in a complete position to take a look and look at the provisions that are in that. Even he should be looking at the provisions that are in that order.
If someone falsely says it's stipulated to, it's on the prosecutor to figure that out.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, the prosecutor would know whether it was stipulated to or not. And, you know, I think, you know, as the court mentioned, the stipulation is a little bit of an overstatement as to what happened in the court proceeding at that time. But the prosecutor is free to interpret that on his own, because, you know, in reality, the prosecutor did say he had a problem with some of the language at the hearing. So he knows whether it's been stipulated to or not. He knows whether he's got issues with the order. And so, I don't think that statement is anything that would have discouraged the prosecutor from reading the order. I mean, he does talk about the language in the email, so he knows it's not. I think that turns out to be, I don't know if the judge even focused on that, but I just don't think that's an issue here, because the prosecutor knows it wasn't stipulated to, because he emails back his own comments about issues he has with the order. So he says he read the order.
Well, stipulated to with the exception of paragraph 4 is what I think was presented afterwards, and paragraph 4 was like, that was the topic of that hearing.
Yeah.
It's stipulated to accept paragraph 4. I include paragraph 4, and then the court said, okay, I'm not giving paragraph 4, but I'm going to sign the rest that was stipulated to. Turns out the rest of it was not stipulated to. And I think the question is, was that, you know, and the district court found that to be, I don't know, sneaky.
Would it have been preferable practice to lay out every single provision in there and discuss it with the prosecutor? That's not in the form order, you know. I mean, would have saved some trouble, but is that misconduct when you have this short document that's actually put out there for everyone to see and read, and it was read by both, at least part of it was read by both the judge and the prosecutor, and is it Mr. Nikitas's responsibility to the point that he should be sanctioned because he didn't point out every single thing that he added to that order? You know, he thought he discussed it with the prosecutor, it was okay. Apparently, he didn't. But again, it's not, that's why you circulate these things ahead of time so everyone can read them and note that if there's some kind of a problem and the problem wasn't noticed until after the order signed and then you had these additional proceedings and that shouldn't be something that Mr. Nikitas is sanctioned for. And I know we got into this a lot, so just if I could just add a couple of points that I think Rule 11 sanctions aren't appropriate to expungement proceedings. They're treated as criminal proceedings. You know, on the web, you know, if you look on the court website, the form is under criminal forms for expungements. It's part of a criminal case. And then also there's definitely no authority under the Uselman versus Uselman case for sanctioning Mr. Nikitas for something that he did in front of the Court of Appeals.
All right, thank you. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days of today's date. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. To those who are here on the Kestner file, we're still working on this automobile accident that happened with the lawyer who was one of the lawyers who was here on the second case. So I think we'll get started fairly close to 11:15, but if we don't get started on time, it's not because we're having a party. It's because we're trying to figure out what to do with this lawyer whose car was just pulled out of the ditch, and he's apparently fine. Sarah, would you see if you can get the respondent's counsel in here again so I can bring her up to date?
Yeah, definitely.
I have an email that I didn't even read yet. Oh, never mind.
No.
The email that I hadn't read gives me the answer that I was looking for, and that is that apparently it's going to be rescheduled by ITV at a later date, and Ms. The boss apparently agrees with that and is okay. So then we're going to take a short break, a very short one now, to just get a reconstituted panel because one of the panelists recused on this next file. So we'll be in recess for about 10 minutes. Sarah, do we have counsel for the respondent?
I was just gonna.
Boy, we've had quite a
set. We're ready to go, Your
Honor. Well, we are a few minutes early. I think we're going to wait and see if they're out in a conference room or something.
My understanding is that some members of respondents' group are here, but I don't know if counsel records are here.
Okay. Well, we'll see.
We'll get it together someday here.
I think we've got somebody coming. The final matter on our oral calendar for this morning is the guardianship of Jack Earl Kestner. Am I saying the name correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And it looks like both of counsel are here and ready to proceed. You will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. And it just dawns on me, you've got a cross appeal. I think I'm just going to give you each 5 for rebuttal. More is better than less, I guess. Everybody okay with that? So you'd have rebuttal, but limited to your cross appeal questions. State your name and the party or parties you represent before you begin your comments so that we've got that for the recording. The podium is adjustable. There's a little toggle switch down there somewhere, so adjust that to meet your comfort, and then whenever appellant's counsel is ready, you may proceed.
Could I ask one question?
Sure.
You say my 5-minute rebuttal is limited to what?
To the cross appeal.
To my cross appeal.
Right, that just seems like it would make sense to me, but.
All right, so I was planning on addressing my cross appeal in my 15-minute section.
Right.
And then responding to their appeal in my 5-minute section.
Tell you what, use your time for whatever you want. If it looks to me like you've got too far afield, I'll bring that to your attention. How's that sound fair?
Sure.
Okay, and I'll try to be fair to everybody. All right, go ahead.
Oh,
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jevin Binman. I represent the appellant, Karen Earl. Your Honors, it's clear that something went very wrong in this case. GCS was hired in a limited capacity to serve as limited co-guardian for Jack Kestner, Ms. Earl's son, with Ms. Earl serving as general guardian. Instead, GCS charged my client $126,000 over an 11-month period. GCS put its profits in front of the welfare of its charge, and its unreasonable billing practices cannot be tolerated. Now, the district court correctly disallowed over half of what GCS was seeking, but it erred in two critical respects. First, the district court awarded attorney's fees with no legal basis, and particularly fees that have nothing to do with GCS's guardianship duties. Second, the district court awarded guardianship and attorney's fees related to, that were incurred after Ms. Earl's guardianship after Ms. Earl's guardianship was suspended.
That was in August, right?
That was in August of 2018, yes. Now, in our briefing, we discussed how the service agreement and the stipulation don't allow GCS to recover any attorney's fees, and that's well briefed, and I'd like to focus on a couple of categories of fees that are clearly not allowed under those documents. The first one is what I'm going to call collection fees. These are fees incurred on GCS's motions to compel fees.
That's the you've identified a list of those starting on page 8 of your brief, beginning May 30th of 2018 and going on through October 29th, right?
That's correct.
Go ahead.
Yes, and those are that's a list of fees that are clearly in the category of collection fees. The district court did not separate those fees in the order. So
I can't tell from the documents that I've seen. I can't tell if those are all related to collection. How do I know that?
Well, the only discovery that was conducted in this case was related to the motions to compel payment. So there's several references to discovery.
There are.
In that list, and so that's the reason that those are listed there.
Was there not a January hearing?
There was a hearing in January of 2019.
Yes. Was there no discovery related to that hearing? I asked that just as follow-up to, we know discovery is only related to the motion to compel. How do we know that it's not related to the hearing that was 2 months later?
Well, my understanding is that the discovery that was conducted in July to October of 2018 was related to the November hearing on the motion to compel fees.
And how do we know that? Like, what would, if we were to, you're asking us to decide that, in fact, all of this relates only to November and it's a mistake. What tells us that? We have to go and, what about this list tells us where to go to figure out that it's clear error to decide that that related to, any of it related to the guardianship?
Well, so the interrogatories are, which I don't believe are in the addendum, but they are in the record from the district court. So that's part of the discovery that we're talking about here is the interrogatories. There's some deposition transcripts that are also, I believe one of them might even be in respondent's addendum. And if you look at those, it'll show that those are all related to the fee issues and not related to any of the guardianship issues.
Is the entire deposition related to fees?
I believe it is.
Do we have the entire deposition?
I don't think we do. I have some pages of it, but I don't think we have the whole thing.
I don't believe that the entire deposition is in the record, no. I'll have to...
You can check and respond on it during your rebuttal time if you want, rather than pause it. But I can't find it, so if you do find it, tell me where it is.
Okay. I will certainly take a look for that.
What about, for example, you include, like in that list, there's at the bottom of page 8, work related to a visitation issue. There's also, on that same page, draft motion for guardianship. Why are those related to the motion to, why would we know that those are related to the motion?
Right, and I will admit that there are some attorney's fees that are related to guardianship that would be allowed. And those two entries that you just listed, the part of them was probably more related to guardianship and part is not.
Because, I mean, what's difficult about this on appeal, if we're being asked to say that it was a clear error, like leaving aside your other arguments about attorney's fees, but assuming that attorney's fees could be collected for the guardianship, it's clear error for the district court to award fees for this. And then your brief says, and I'm quoting, these services, which related solely to Mr. Wexler's efforts to collect his fees, including the following entries, and then even on their face, the following entries don't appear to be related solely to collecting fees. It seems to ask a lot of work of us as an appellate court, without further citation to the record, how to figure out that these are not related to the guardianship. How do we do that? And how would we even figure out what amount of money is at stake? And if some portion of these, even by now, your own acknowledgement, these bulleted items, in fact, appear to relate to the guardianship, not to the fees?
Well, I do think that a remand would be necessary to determine those amounts. So the appellant would be requesting that the court remand to the district court with instructions on disallowing fees that are related, that are not related to guardianship, that are related to collection or other non-guardianship duties.
So is your I want to make sure now that I'm clearly understanding your argument. Is your argument that the district court clearly erred in making the findings that it did, or is your argument that we should remand without reversing for more complete findings so that we can review what it did?
I suppose it's a little bit of both. I think that the district court did clearly err with respect to certain entries, at least. I acknowledge that there are some entries that it's a little bit less clear on what the entry is referring to and whether it's a guardianship or a other type of service.
Are all the entries on pages 8 and 9 and 10, the way that that's introduced makes it seem like these are fees that were requested, and then the following paragraphs describe the fees that were awarded. Do you know if each of these entries was awarded?
It was, and with the exception of on page 9, there's a footnote that the district court reduced the amount of one fee, but The district court awarded almost all of the attorney's fees requested in the first fees hearing, with respect to a few entries that are not on this list. In the second fees hearing, the district court did eliminate all fees that were related to collection efforts, and that's part of the problem here, is that we have an inconsistency between the first hearing and the second hearing. In the second hearing, the district court clearly disallowed those fees and noted that they shouldn't have been charged in the first place.
Is it necessarily true that if a district court, in its exercise of discretion in the second hearing, disallows some fees, that it necessarily abused its discretion in allowing similar fees on an earlier occasion under different circumstances?
It's not necessarily true, but in this case, I would note that the district court in the first fees hearing stated that it had a duty to determine whether GCS's attorney's fees were, whether they were entitled to those fees and whether they should have been charged. So the district court noted its duty to do that and then proceeded not to. So the inconsistency in the second hearing is further shaded by that. And the other point I'll make, too, as a policy argument, is that allowing these types of collection fees to be charged under a guardianship contract like this just encourages a company to churn the file and to charge inordinate amount of fees. We're talking about here $34,000 of attorney's fees charged in a guardianship matter.
In the cases I read, it seems like the courts often, the appellate courts, have emphasized the need for district courts to pay close attention to those things, especially in cases where the payment is being made from the estate of the ward. This is a little bit different in that there's a contractual arrangement, right?
That's correct. Yeah, and there's a very clear line of case law stating that statutory recovery from an estate, there's public policy reasons why we don't want a guardianship company or conservatorship to overstep their bounds. Here, as a contractual issue, the question is, did GCS comply with the contract, and did they were the fees that were charged fees that were allowable under the contract? Just very briefly on the attorney's fees issue, I'll just also note that the district court erred by allowing GCS to charge $250 an hour for their attorney services as opposed to the $100 an hour that's in the service agreement. Ms. Earle never saw the retainer agreement that discussed the $250 an hour and never agreed to that. So as an additional point, appellant would request that the amount of fees be recalculated at $100 an hour for the attorney fee portion.
When was Ms. Earle made aware that was the arrangement?
She probably received an invoice at or around the time that the first motion for fees was issued. That would have been around the time that the first attorney fee.
What about the first invoice?
Well, the first invoice, I mean, it would have said $250 an hour, I suppose, at the bottom, but that was at the same time that that the motion for fees was brought.
So in, let's say, March 2018, maybe that's the second invoice, and in that invoice you would see much more than the $500 that Ms. Earle expected.
Well,
at that point, wouldn't you expect someone to kind of dig a little deeper and find out what's going on?
Well, there's two different sets of invoices. There's GCS's invoices and GCS's attorney's invoices.
Right.
So GCS started invoicing in March of 2018.
And that's the invoice I'm talking about.
Okay. So just to be clear, the attorney fee invoice wasn't given until June of 2018.
Any attorney fees incurred as of that first invoice in March?
There were no attorney fees that were invoiced at that time until June. And that's the same time that the motion for fees was brought. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. Thank you.
Very briefly on the second point, as of August 10th, 2018, Ms. Earle was no longer serving as guardian. The service agreement specifically states that the agreement is in place until the co-guardian is discharged. Now, there's a little bit of unclarity about who the co-guardian is, but the only person in the service agreement that is listed as co-guardian is Ms. Earle. So even if the language is ambiguous, GCS drafted the agreement, it would be construed in favor of Ms. Earle. And more to the point of that, as of August 10th, 2018, the parties' understanding of the contract of their relationship had materially changed, where GCS was now serving as general guardian, incurring many more fees. Of the $126,000 that they charged, approximately $75,000 was after August 10th of 2018. And Ms. Earle at that point was completely cut out. She had no ability to... she had no guardianship ability, and GCS continued to charge, and she couldn't do anything about it at that point. Now, because of the material change in those circumstances, the service agreement was terminated at that point, and Ms. Earle would not incur any expenses after that point. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.